crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Welcome to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nuchtigal, and welcome also to 2017, bound to be a huge year for both archaeological discoveries and also news out of the Middle East, prophetically significant news. Well, this week there just continues to be more fallout from the recent UN Security Council resolution, which is largely billed as the anti-settlement resolution. And on today's show, we're going to look into that resolution once again, but we'll examine it from a different angle and to see how that resolution was not really about settlements in the West Bank. We'll see how it was actually a blatant attack on the unity of the city of Jerusalem. That's coming up in the second half of today's show. But before we get to that, I wanted to just take the first part of today's show to discuss a couple of stories from the last few weeks regarding archaeology here in Israel. And the first of those is kind of a sad story. It is about the stone wall that has collapsed in Tel Dan. Tel Dan, you might remember that story. The piece on Watch Jerusalem about that very important biblically significant site in Israel's north, the far north, part of the land that the tribe of Dan actually conquered and won. And as was their custom, they named the town Dan. It used to be Leshem or Laish. And after they settled that, it was an important cultic center for Jeroboam, the first king of the northern tribes of Israel, once they split off from the house of David. And that city continued to be important. It was actually important even before the Israelite period. When you get back into Abraham's time as well, it's mentioned in Genesis chapter 14. Well, in the past couple of weeks, they've received about 200 millimeters of rain there. And one of these stone walls that is just a really quite a tall stone wall, is probably 3 or 4 meters from my recollection last time I was there, right outside the city gate there from this Israelite period, was damaged. It fell down, the stone wall, these are quite large, these stones, probably about 3 feet by 2 feet, something like that. And it collapsed upon the courtyard there and upon some probable ancient graves. And it's quite sad to see if you've ever visited Tel Dan. It's a beautiful part of the country. I would say probably the most beautiful, if you like water, the Dan Spring, the largest spring in the Middle East, is there, really does well water this site, and probably part of the reason why it was chosen by the tribe of Dan to settle there because of the amount of water. And there's a beautiful archaeological park there, take you probably a couple hours to get through it. And you can walk through this city gate, but as I said, the construction around that city gate did fall down this past week. The chief archaeologist of the Israel Nature and Parks Authority said, quote, "It's a sad and unfortunate to see such damages by the forces of nature to unique and very important treasures of history and heritage." And that's certainly true. This is a very important site, as I was saying. This is where they found the Tel Dan Stele, which does mention the House of David. As well, Beth David back in 1993, so it's important for that. But it's also important because it does detail Israel's history through time. It's just a lot of different periods of habitation exist at this site, and we'll see. They are looking into how to restore that. There could be one positive that comes out of it. A lot of the time when nature does do its damage on sites like this, they do a lot of the time find archaeologically significant things as well in the cleanup. I remember, I think it was a year or two ago, there was quite a big storm in the eastern Mediterranean and the Israeli coast off Caesarea, and a lot of the sand was removed because of that storm by the waves and such coming up onto the beach, and there was a significant statue that was actually uncovered by nature after that storm. So we'll see if they discover anything else from this. They will be able to restore it hopefully within a few months back to its original look, so that you'll be able to visit Tel Dan once again and see that. Well, there's another story here that came on the eve of the start of Hanukkah, and that was that a 2,000-year-old coin from that period, from the Maccabean Revolt, was found in Jerusalem. This was found at the Tower of David Citadel, which is right at the entrance to the city, Old City of Jerusalem, by the Jaffa Gate there. If you go through the Jaffa Gate and you look to your right, that is the Tower of David Citadel. But it doesn't relate to King David at all. It's from 1,000 years after his time, even at its earliest period, here during the time of the Maccabees. And what they found there was a bronze coin that was in circulation at the time of King Antiochus IV. This was Antiochus Epiphanes. He was the one that decreed that the Jews must be annihilated and that the Jewish law must be destroyed as well. And that led to this period or this celebration of the Festival of Lights, Festival of Dedication, or known as Hanukkah today, where the temple was rededicated after he desecrated it. And this coin, while it itself, I guess, there have been many other coins in Jerusalem of Antiochus Epiphanes found from this same period. There was even, I think it was a year and a half ago, there was some published relating to the Acra from King Antiochus's time that he built the fortress, the citadel that he built to overlook the temple grounds. That was discovered in the northern reaches of the city of David, the actual city of David, just outside the Dung Gate of Jerusalem's old city today. And they found numerous coins of Antiochus Epiphanes in the construction, in the walls and in the glacis attached to the walls from Antiochus's time. And again, it is important to recognize that this history from 2,100 years ago was real. The Jews did have an adversary that really did try and destroy them completely and destroy the religion of the Jews as well. And this coin was probably minted during his reign. Well, obviously it was minted during his reign. He reigned from, I think it was 175, I'm just going through memory here, 175 to 162, probably something like that. Obviously his attack on the Jews started around 168. So they found another coin from his period as well, with his head on it, as leaders like to do. And then there was another discovery in Jerusalem. This one was made at the Gavati parking lot. This is that same excavation outside the Dung Gate that's been going on for years. I would say probably the first time I came to Jerusalem back in 2006 to work on the Palace of David excavation in the northern part of the city of David, there was already this other excavation that had begun to the west of that, just off the spur of the city of David in the little valley there. And that's known as the Gavati or parking lot excavation, because they were doing this excavation because they wanted to have a parking lot in that location, or build one. They still want to do that, I guess, in the future. Well, at that site where they did find this citadel from Antiochus Epiphanes' time, they also found an inscription this past week of the name Hyrcanus. Hyrcanus. Now, this is a name that's quite important to this same period of history, the Hasmonean period, or the period of the Maccabees. And this was written or carved into a stone bowl. And it's said that these stone bowls were found quite a lot around the temple area. The traditional reasoning for that is that stone was used inside the temple service, because stone, it's very difficult for water to get through it, unlike pottery, which does leach a little bit over time. But stone is considered to be a more pure substance that they could use inside the temple ground. So on a stone vessel just outside where the temple would have been this past week, they did find a bowl that had the name Hyrcanus written on it. Now, we don't really know exactly who this Hyrcanus is. Doron Ben-Ami, he's the chief archaeologist there, he said that there were, this is him to Jerusalem Post, there were famous figures with this name at the time, Yohanan Hyrcanus, who was Mattathias the Hasmonean's grandson and governor over Judea, as well as a couple of generations after him as well. So this Hyrcanus is quite important in, if it is the Hyrcanus that is the main one that was Mattathias Hasmonean's grandson, that would have been Judas Maccabee's nephew. If it is him, it was quite an important figure. He ruled from 135 to 103 BC. I'll just call him John Hyrcanus. I'll anglicize his name to make it a bit easier for me. Well, he was a ruler after the period of Simon the Hasmonean. When the Maccabees rebelled against Antiochus Epiphanes' rule and his diktats against them, Mattathias was the one that was in charge. He was the father of a number of leaders to come on after him, the most prominent of those leaders being Judas. And then another brother ruled after Judas was killed. And then another brother, Simon, he ruled from 142 BC onwards. And underneath Simon, this was the period in which the Maccabees received the high priesthood. They also, while they didn't claim that they were king, they were definitely the ethnarch, the rulers over the Jews as well. Now, when Simon died, and Simon was a direct descendant, a son of Mattathias, who really did raise up a righteous rebellion against Antiochus Epiphanes because of his desire to stamp out the Jewish law completely, those three sons of Mattathias, they ruled well, as it seems. But then once we get into John Hyrcanus's rule, he does enact a number of policies that were against the Bible. And the Pharisees at the time had a problem with the way that Hyrcanus was ruling. For one, they didn't like the fact that the high priest was a general, and Hyrcanus did take that the office of high priest, and also the fact, and also the title of general of the forces of the Jews. The Sadducees at the time really didn't see a problem with that, but the Pharisees didn't like the concept of the high priest shedding blood in war. High priests had never done that before, so should they be doing that now? And then to wage this campaign, or the expansion really of the Jewish kingdom at this point, he started to employ Greek mercenaries in the Jewish army. And up to this point, it was just Jewish citizens really that were used in the army of the Maccabees. But now he thought, John Hyrcanus, again, this name that was found in a vessel just outside of Jerusalem's old city today, if they were able to continue winning battles under him, they needed help. They needed better help. So he hired mercenaries, Greeks, that would come and fight for them. Against their adversaries to expand the territory. The Pharisees were upset with this as well, because this wasn't, the way that the Hyrcanus ended up paying them, these mercenaries, was to give them small plots of land, to give them land grants in Judea. So now you have Greeks starting to live among the Jews because of the use of Greek mercenaries. And again, this is about 1,000 years or 660 years before Herod the Great. And he actually, the way that Herod the Great came to rule over Judea probably comes back to this time of Hyrcanus as well, because the third thing that he did that was quite upsetting to the Pharisees and definitely against biblical law is that he started to forcefully convert people. He wanted to expand the Jewish state, so he took over Galilee. He took over Idumea in the south as well and forced the people to convert. Now, there's nothing wrong with people to convert, but if somebody's forced against it, to convert, you can't really see examples of that in the Bible. And yet that's what John Hyrcanus did. And, you know, this would be a bad thing for the nation if they converted or forcefully converted a large group of people that, you know, really weren't committed to this way, that way of life. They would mix their pagan religion, former religion, into the Jewish religion. And what you had then was a lot of completely insincere people, insincere converts that came out of that. And one of those regions, as I said, that Hyrcanus took over was the region of Idumea. And who came from Idumea? Well, this was where the family, the generations of the Herods grew up. And 100 years after this time, Herod the Great would be ruling over Judea, and he wasn't even a full-blooded Jew. He was one of these forcefully converted Idumeans, possibly, you know, the continuation of the Edomites ruling over the Jews. So obviously that was a bit of a backfire as well. Well, they are just three discoveries or events here in the archaeological world in the past week. We did have a question come in, a bit of feedback from the West Indies. We've had quite a lot of feedback that's come in. I just wanted to read this one because it involved a question. And I'd like to encourage anybody, if you have questions out there, be it related to Israel, archaeology of Israel, while I'm not an expert in all these things, we can definitely find out the answer for you if you want. So this piece of feedback comes from the West Indies, one of our listeners out there. She says, great program. I must say that the idea to start this program was great indeed, because a lot of things begin in Jerusalem, and that's certainly true. And then she goes on to say, one day I was looking at History Channel, if I remember correctly, doing a program on David and Goliath, and one of the presenters made it plain that there was little evidence for King David's existence, save for one piece of stone written by another nation. So what she's likely referring to there, or what the program was likely referring to, is an artifact that we've covered quite a lot in this program already. Very important one, the Tel Dan Stele. And that, again, was discovered at Tel Dan. And she's right, it is a victory stele that was written by another people that mentions the house of David, or Beth David. It was written about 100 years after David was alive. And yet it is the most concrete evidence that we have to this King David existing, at least as far as an inscription goes. Now, it is important to add as well that there are likely two additional inscriptions that aren't as certain as the Tel Dan inscription, but they do refer to King David. The most famous one of these is the Mesher inscription. This belonged to the king of Moab, in which the house of David is mentioned again. There is one letter missing from David's name. But most people generally agree that this does mention King David as well. And then the final example is more of a recent one, and this is from an Egyptian inscription, possibly dating to the time around King or Pharaoh Shishak in the late 10th century BC. And Shishak was the one responsible for a destruction through Judea and parts of Israel during the reign of Rehoboam after King Solomon died. Now, that inscription refers to a part of the Negev desert, or the Negev region in the south of Judea, and it calls that area the Heights of David. The Heights of David. So who's David? Well, if it's from this inscription, looks like it's from 100 years after David, or probably less than that, 50 years after David, and it's calling something the Heights of David in the southern territory of Judea, or the Negev Desert. So this could likely refer to King David as well. Now, that inscription records David as being David, and some people say, well, that might not mean David. Well, ancient Ethiopians, they rendered the name as David, as David, so with a T instead of a D at the end. So that possibility does definitely remain, that this inscription does refer to King David. Now, continuing on from her question, she says, he went on to say, this program on the History Channel about David and Goliath, that he went on to say that the armor, that the Bible describes Goliath as wearing did not exist at the time, and he implied that the story was made up. My question is then, again, this is from the West Indies, is apart from pottery, is there any way to verify armor and weapons to the time period the Bible ascribes them to? Now, this is very interesting. You can look at armor, and we do have a lot of inscriptions and drawings, if you talk about Assyrian or Babylonian or even Egyptian armor, of what that looked like, for sure. And you can say that, well, they have this armor, and then we can tell from inscriptions and different ancient drawings written, inscribed in stone, that this was likely an Assyrian soldier or a Babylonian soldier from the armor that they wore. The armor definitely did change. When we're talking about King David, though, and this period of Goliath as well, the reason that history program probably did try and discredit Goliath from wearing that armor is because it looks like, as the Bible describes, that armor was typical to the 6th century rather than the 10th or 11th century in the Philistine territories. And it looks like it was Greek armor that the Bible describes rather than Philistine armor. Now, what's interesting about this is that, as we've even covered in this program, the Philistines did have their roots in the Mycenaean Greek region. The Philistines did have a common thread with their history, their dress as well, their stories. That does seem to be Greek in nature. The main issue that people have with Goliath's armor is that he wore greaves, or the armor plating, on his legs. And this is something that's typical of Greek armor, yet it doesn't seem to exist for another few hundred years in Greece itself. So they would say, well, the Bible is obviously written something, this story was made up because this armor doesn't exist, or we haven't found it yet earlier than the 6th century BC. So then they would disagree with this whole story of David and Goliath. I mean, of course, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to think that putting armor on your legs is a good idea, especially if you are a tall giant and you needed to protect the lower portion of your body. And especially if Goliath was a champion, their showpiece, he would likely be decked out in a way that none of the other Philistine fighters were. And that scene of David and Goliath, where you have champions being presented, one from Israel and one from the Philistines, being presented to fight one another before the main battle, I mean, that comes out of Greek writing as well, right? So you could say that this is just a early example of that same culture. You know, our knowledge of the Philistines through archaeology is really still only in its early stages, especially in terms of their military. If you're going to say that, hey, we haven't found this yet, this type of armor on the Philistines, so Goliath couldn't have worn it, I would just say just wait and see. Just wait and see. As with a lot of biblically significant things, there are plenty of scoffers that would say that just because it hasn't been found yet, it never existed. Well, that's what they said about King David as well, until they found the Teldown Steles. So we have proof that this outfit that Goliath did wear was influenced by the Greeks. It's similar to the Greeks. And really, that's what the Bible says, if we just take it at face value, that the Philistines probably did inherit some of their culture from the Greeks as well. So thank you for your feedback all the way from the West Indies. Again, if you have any questions about our programming, you can email us at letters@watchjerusalem.co.il, or you can send a question via Twitter if you'd like to do that. Simply put @watch_Jerusalem first and then write your question. That'll come right to us. Or you can do a similar thing on our Facebook page as well. Coming up this week on Watch Jerusalem, Christopher Eames, he's written the next installment of the Bible's Buried Cities. This time he looks at Kirbet Kaiapha, this fortress of David. You can look for that on the website on Tuesday as well. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to look at both recent UN resolutions against Israel, the United Nations Security Council, and also the UNESCO resolution against Israel, and look at how they take aim not just at Israel, but at Jerusalem, Jerusalem itself. This is a powerfully prophetic trend that we must keep our eyes on. We'll be right back.
This is Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive. Thank you for listening. They call it the City of Peace. But it is filled with violence. Yesterday, bloody crusades and sieges. Today, terrorism, rocket attacks, and stabbings. Intense international pressure, but no diplomatic solutions. This is Jerusalem. No city has suffered like it. Will there ever be peace? God says yes. There will be peace in Jerusalem, and not just for the Jews. It will be a peace that spreads to all people. How will God bring peace to Jerusalem? Request your free copy of Jerusalem in Prophecy to find out. The answer comes straight from your Bible. Peace is coming soon. Act today. Please visit thetrumpet.com. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nachtigall. As I was saying at the top of the show, there continues to be a lot of fallout from the recent UN Security Council resolution, and there's many possible storylines to talk about this. We could talk about Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and President Obama's battle that's been going on, the personal battle, really, that's been going on for the past 8 years. We could talk about President Obama's desire to leave a pro-Palestinian, anti-Israel legacy. Remember, this Security Council resolution cannot be undone. We could also talk about the story of whether President Obama didn't not only veto it, but whether he was behind the scenes promoting the resolution to come to the table. And then we could also look at whether there is going to be another act by this administration in the last 3 weeks that looks like it could happen. We could also take a look at the resolution itself and what it actually says. And we're going to do quite a lot of that in the second half. One part of the resolution calls upon all states to distinguish in their dealings between the territory of the State of Israel and the territories occupied since 1967. This is a really important clause in there because it really does put air in the sails of the anti-Semitic BDS, or Boycott, Divest, and Sanction movement that really had seemed to be losing ground over the past couple of years. But now, for the first time, that movement has the international backing of the United Nations. The United Nations is calling on all states, all nations in the world, to start distinguishing between things that are from the West Bank and things that are from the other parts of Israel, and start distinguishing in their dealings and not buy those products from companies that have dealings, Israeli companies that have dealings inside the West Bank. Now, regarding this point, Carolyn Glick of the Jerusalem Post this past week really tore into that, saying that as for the boycott campaign against Israel, contrary to what has widely been argued, 2334 does not strengthen the boycott of settlements. 2334 gives a strategic boost to the boycott of Israel as a whole. That's what it does. It's not about just saying boycotting goods from the settlements. Why? Well, she goes on to explain. She said 2334 calls on all states to, quote, distinguish in their relevant dealings between the territory of the State of Israel and the territories occupied since 1967. So what does that mean? She goes on to say, since no Israeli firms make that distinction, all Israeli economic activity is now threatened with boycott. No Israeli company separates between the West Bank and Jerusalem. They wouldn't. You could. Or West Bank, sorry, and Israel proper. I'll just give it that title for the sake of you understanding what I mean. No Israeli company differentiates, really, between East Jerusalem, the West Bank, its dealings there, and the rest of Israel. She goes on to say Tnuva is an occupation dairy, in quotes, because it supplies communities beyond the 1949 lines with dairy products. So this milk company, this dairy company, if that supplies people in the West Bank with some of its products, does that make it an occupation in quotes company? The UN believes it does. Bank Hapoalim is an occupation bank, apparently, because it operates ATM machines in post-1967 neighborhoods in Jerusalem. So if you've got an ATM as an Israeli bank, which they all do in East Jerusalem today, apparently you are supporting the occupation. Fox clothing chain, she goes on to write, is an occupation chain because it has a store in Gush Etzion, and so on and so forth. And she writes, Resolution 2334 gives Europe and its NGOs a green light to wage a complete trade and cultural boycott against all of Israel. All of Israel. So the BDS movement now has wins in its sails from this resolution. But the main thing that I want to talk about isn't this BDS movement, because I think that would be something that picks up, but it's not the most concerning part of the resolution. The second half of today's show is going to show that this resolution really is a game changer in terms of Jerusalem. Jerusalem. The unity of Jerusalem was the real target in this resolution. This isn't about settlements. This isn't about incitement. The key difference really from this resolution to all others is that Jerusalem itself is now on the chopping block. And that's backed by the nations of this world, supported by the current United States administration. And now you have a United Nations Security Council resolution that will not be undone. Now, this is what the resolution says itself. These are the first 3 points. Point number one, the United Nations Security Council reaffirms that the establishment by Israel of settlements in the Palestinian territory occupied since 1967, including East Jerusalem, has no legal validity and constitutes a flagrant violation under international law and a major obstacle to the achievement of the two-state solution and a just, lasting, comprehensive peace. So notice that this isn't just about settlements that are in far-off regions of the West Bank or Judea and Samaria. This is about East Jerusalem, and they wanted to make sure that people realize, that Israel realizes, that they are targeting East Jerusalem specifically now. East Jerusalem, according, if you live in East Jerusalem, you have, as a Jew, you have no legal validity to be there. The Israeli government has no legal validity to, under international law, to be occupying or living in or governing that territory. This is what Jonathan Tobin wrote for a commentary magazine about that. He says, quote, while the previous resolutions, like other ones in the United Nations Security Council in the past, they've unfairly criticized the Jewish state, none of them specifically labeled, I'll read this quote again, while previous resolutions unfairly criticized the Jewish state, none of them specifically labeled the Jewish presence in the territory Israel took control of in the 1967 Six-Day War as illegal. So this is new. They're calling it illegal. It means that the hundreds of thousands of Jews living in the decades-old Jewish neighborhoods of the city of Jerusalem, or in settlement blocks that even Obama has conceded would remain inside Israel in the event of a peace treaty, are now international outlaws. So yes, it's about the outer settlements in the West Bank, but it's also about and specifically targeting East Jerusalem. Now, point two, it says this, United Nations Security Council reiterates its demand that Israel immediately and completely cease all settlement activities in the occupied Palestinian territory. In case you don't know what that is, Israel, including East Jerusalem, as it writes, and that it fully respects all of its legal obligations in this regard. So you've got to stop building in East Jerusalem as well, because there right now we have determined that is not your land. Point number three says this, the United Nations Security Council underlines that it will not recognize any changes to the June 4th, 1967 lines, including with regard to Jerusalem, other than those agreed to by the parties through negotiations. So why single out Jerusalem here? Why single out Jerusalem? This is different. Why not just say the West Bank or the territories of Judea and Samaria? Because according to the negotiations for peace over the past 30 years, the West Bank was always going to go to the Palestinians as part of a final peace deal. But Jerusalem wasn't predetermined. Until this United Nations Security Council, Jerusalem was not predetermined. The future of Jerusalem, what would happen in an eventual peace deal between Palestinians and Israelis? Jerusalem was not part of the deal of getting the West Bank. Jerusalem was to be negotiated completely separately as a separate part of the negotiations. And it was very much likely going to stay completely in Israeli hands. governed by Israel. But now, according to the UN, as of two Fridays ago, the UN, including the United States, not only can the Israelis not build or live in Judea and Samaria, but now any building in East Jerusalem past the invisible ceasefire lines of 1949, the same as 1967, that's illegal. Israel can't do that. The UN has determined, the world has determined that East Jerusalem doesn't belong to Israel. That's what just happened a couple of Fridays ago at the UN Security Council. And that's what's so scary, really, about this resolution. I'm going to quote from Dory Gold's book. He wrote The Fight for Jerusalem a number of years ago. He's the head of the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. He's a close friend, confidant, advisor to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who he was just till last week, the Director General of the Israeli Foreign Ministry. And he wrote a book, A Fight for Jerusalem, all about this fight over Jerusalem, not just about two states for two peoples, about the fight being over Jerusalem. And I'll quote, he says, from 1967 until the year 2000, the door for Israeli withdrawal from Jerusalem was largely closed. It wasn't going to happen. Israel is not going to withdraw from Jerusalem. Now, year 2000, that was the time of the Camp David Accords. He's speaking of that time when Ehud Barak, the former Prime Minister of Israel, and really to his great shame, presented the terrorist PLO chairman Yasser Arafat with a proposal whereby the Palestinians would receive control over East Jerusalem and most of the West Bank. That's what happened in 2000. Jerusalem, for the first time, really was put on the table, on the negotiating table, in a very real sense. Now, up to this time, Jerusalem was to be the subject of negotiation in the future, but it was a completely separate point. And it was one really where Israeli governments before Ehud Barak had said that they were not going to give it up. Yitzhak Rabin, he was the prime minister, obviously, when the Oslo Accords took place. And what he declared was that Jerusalem must always remain the united capital of Israel. That's what he said in October 95 in his last Knesset speech, a month before he was assassinated. But that was the general consensus among Israelis, that Jerusalem must remain the united capital of Israel. Yet Barak, who was really followed on from Rabin and yet didn't hold true to his legacy, he would go against this in the year 2000. I'd like to quote more from the introduction of Dory Gold's book, Fight for Jerusalem. This is what he says. Jerusalem was almost lost in July 2000 when the future of its old city walls was first put on the negotiating table. President Bill Clinton convened what would become a 15-day marathon summit at Camp David in the United States to fully resolve once and for all the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Israelis and Palestinians were sealed off in the presidential retreat in Maryland and pressured to hammer out a final agreement. The whole event was a political long shot. Relations between the leaders, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat, were close to hostile and the pre-summit preparation was poor. Nevertheless, Barak agreed to cede to Palestinians sovereignty over most of East Jerusalem's suburbs, sovereignty of the old city's Muslim and Christian quarters, and custodianship over Judaism's holiest site, the Temple Mount. Since the Israeli Defense Forces had captured Jerusalem's old city in the Six-Day War in 1967, no Israeli prime minister had proposed redividing the city. Now it was happening. Now, this was absolutely astounding for Barak to do this, to be willing to do this. Here was the sacred capital of the Jews, and he was going to give it to the Arabs in return for their promise of peace. Now, at the time, Barak had no mandate to do this. He'd recently lost the Knesset majority. He was even delayed in getting to the US for talks because there was a no-confidence vote against him. So what were his intentions? Why would he give up Jerusalem? East Jerusalem. Divide the city. I'll continue from Mr. Dory Gold here in The Fight for Jerusalem. He says, quote, "If Arafat agreed to his proposals, Barak would bring the Israeli people a historic peace treaty, formally ending the Arab-Israeli conflict. He would then be in a strong position to call new elections. If Arafat refused, Barak calculated that the Palestinians would be exposed before the entire world as the main obstacle to a comprehensive Middle Eastern peace. Barak tried to control the risk by making his proposals indirectly to Arafat through Clinton so that his offers could not be pocketed as a binding commitment by Israel to surrender Jerusalem. And he took solace that the negotiations were based on the principle that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. If refused at Camp David, the unprecedented Israeli offer would be off the table, at least in theory. That's what Dory Gold says, and that's why he was doing it. It would be, according to Barak, win-win. If they said yes, then they get East Jerusalem, but at least we have a peace deal. But he was willing to give up East Jerusalem for that peace deal. Now, we know that Arafat rejected that offer. He rejected it. Why? Because he wants all of Jerusalem. He wanted all of Jerusalem. But now, really, the cat was out of the bag. Israel was willing to negotiate away East Jerusalem. They were willing to do it. They had said previously that Jerusalem would be the undivided capital of Israel, but apparently there were cracks in that. That's what happened in the year 2000. Now, well, when the Israeli public caught wind of what was happening, they were mad. They were mad, and 400,000 of them marched to the old city walls in the largest demonstration in Israeli history in January 2001. Now, at the time, even though Arafat did not accept the deal, stunningly, some Israeli officials were even considering a United Nations Security Council resolution whereby what was offered by Barak, including East Jerusalem, would be locked in to the new negotiating position of the Israelis. Now, that didn't happen back in 2000. There was no Security Council resolution in 2001 that said the new negotiating position of Israel is that East Jerusalem will go back to the Palestinians in a formal peace. But fast forward to 2016... or 2017 now, and we have that Security Council resolution. We have the Security Council resolution whereby Jerusalem is on the chopping block. The international community has decided unilaterally, with the United States' support, that East Jerusalem does not belong to the Jews. That's what happened two Fridays ago. This isn't something that can be negotiated anymore. This is Palestinian land, and the Jews have no right to it. They have no right to live there. Jerusalem, according to them, the United Nations, is not the united capital of the Jews. Already, it's been decided. Now, it's obvious why Israel absolutely rejects this. Giving away the Temple Mount, the Wailing Wall, the City of David, where 3,000 years of artifacts are being constantly dug up and unearthed, that's in East Jerusalem. That's in East Jerusalem. All that, apparently, according to this world, is Palestinian land. It's no longer a concession that the Israelis can negotiate with. The goalposts have now been moved. And East Jerusalem, I'm sorry, Israel, that's not a bargaining chip anymore at all. That already does belong to the Palestinians, just like the rest of Judea and Samaria. Now, it's interesting. If you go back to October, remember the UNESCO resolutions as well, that everyone got upset that they didn't recall or mention in that resolution that the Temple Mount has any Jewish history to it. But as we drew attention to at the time, there was more sinister things going on with that resolution. That Section 5 of that resolution says this, that UNESCO deeply deplores the failure of Israel, the occupying power. It deeply deplores the failure of Israel to what? To cease the persistent excavations and works in East Jerusalem, particularly in and around the Old City. Why were they doing that? Why did they deplore that Israel was not ceasing those excavations in East Jerusalem? Because that now belongs to the Palestinians. That's not Israel's territory to conduct archaeological excavations in. And yet, if we're talking about the history of the Bible, Jewish history, where do you find that? Well, you find that in those areas of East Jerusalem. That's where the Jews, Israel, was living. Sorry, Israel, United Nations says. Sorry, Israel, the United States now says, according to President Obama, you are now occupying East Jerusalem. Now, why is this important? Why is it important that the UN is coming hard, changing the rules now for future negotiations, saying that East Jerusalem is already Palestinian land? We could say, who cares what the UN says? Who cares? They'll have to enforce it, and good luck any of them coming down with their armies into Jerusalem to force Israel out of East Jerusalem. Now, that's true. While I think most people agree that wouldn't happen. But what if, what would happen if the Palestinians now began another intifada against the Jews? And Israel had to suppress the violence, just like what happened during those negotiations or just after Camp David, the second intifada started. And they called it the Al-Aqsa Intifada, where Arabs, the Palestinians, began blowing up themselves, suicide bombers, all the way through Jerusalem and other parts of Israel. What happened if that started again? And Israel had to go into East Jerusalem, which is their territory, which they govern, and suppress that violence. What would the international community do then? They have just said at the Security Council that that is no longer Israel's territory, that Israel is there illegally, and they have no valid claim to it. Would they act? Would they act harshly against Israel? Now, this is supremely important because East Jerusalem coming up in the news like this brings into focus a very specific biblical prophecy that's found in the book of Zechariah. The very last chapter of the book of Zechariah, chapter 14, has these two verses in it. It says this, verse 1. Verse 1 reveals the context. It says, "Behold, the day of the eternal comes, and your spoil should be devoured in the midst of you." So this is talking about the final year of man's rule over man. The day of the eternal comes, and God's going to rule. But then notice verse 2. And if you want more information about this, please request our booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy by Gerald Flurry. It goes into far greater detail than I can in just this program. It'll make it more clear to you. And you can take your time to prove it. Prove it for yourself. To prove to yourself whether such actions by the United Nations have anything to do with this prophecy in the book of Zechariah. You owe it to yourself to do that. Verse 2 says this, "For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city." Now I'm going to quote directly from Mr. Flurry. He writes this. Notice the big overview Zechariah gives us. There are three phases to this crisis. Zechariah starts at the arrival of the Messiah, the third phase, and then works his way backward chronologically. The verse starts with the Messiah conquering the European and Asian powers who are gathered together for battle at Jerusalem. Then there is a semicolon, which means all these events in verse 2 are linked and closely associated. The first semicolon introduces the second phase of this violent time. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, and the women ravished. This is when the king of the north, or Europe, conquers the whole city of Jerusalem. Now again, I don't have time to get into the king of the north, the Asian and European powers that are coming in. Please request Jerusalem and Prophecy. It'll make it very clear to you. But I'll keep on reading. It says, then there is another semicolon. This is the first phase. The first phase. The first thing to happen before a chain reaction of events takes place before the Messiah comes. Notice what the first phase is. Continue the quote. This is the first phase, when half of Jerusalem goes into captivity, suggesting some violence in the process. This first phase could happen at any time. The Palestinians, backed by Iran, will almost certainly be linked to this violent deed. So why are these three events so closely linked? He writes, I believe there is only one logical answer. The fall of half of Jerusalem triggers a violent and massive chain reaction that leads to the coming of the Messiah. Did you get that? The fall of half Jerusalem triggers a violent and massive chain reaction that leads to the coming of the Messiah based on this prophecy in Zechariah chapter 14. Bible prophecy indicates Jerusalem will be split in half. And that's essentially what the United Nations did. Two Fridays ago, they split Jerusalem in half. Now, facts on the ground do say that Jerusalem is not split in half yet. But according to the rest of the world, Israel is an occupying power in East Jerusalem already. Now, all we have to ask is, how long will it be until that UN resolution is enforced? How long is it going to be? And will it be provoked by an armed struggle by the Palestinians? And will foreign observers come in to keep the peace? when that happens. Now, Mr. Netanyahu, he wouldn't put up with Palestinian control of East Jerusalem. Yet, if the Palestinians make a run for it, what would the international community need to do? Would they act? Now, that's the calculus that we need to think about regarding this prophecy in Zechariah in relation to the United Nations Security Council resolution. Now, clearly, this resolution doesn't further the chances for peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Instead, it undermines Israel's negotiating position. It actually encourages the Palestinian to fight for the land, which, according to the world now, belongs to them already. Now, in the end, though, it's important to remember, and this is where we need to keep our focus, that there is actually peace coming to Jerusalem, and half of Jerusalem falling is part of it. It's part of the chain reaction that leads to peace, finally, in this city. Thousands of years of man's rule has proven that Jerusalem can only, for brief periods of time, experience peace. But by the time this prophecy in Zechariah is completely fulfilled, there will be peace, eternal peace, in this city of Jerusalem. I'm Brent Nachtigall, again coming to you from Jerusalem, Israel. And that brings us to the end of our program. Thank you for listening to Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive.